Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
A form slightly larger than Dritz, but obviously humanoid, drifted around a nearby stalactite. Dritz kicked off a stone to propel himself at it, drawing his other scimitar as he went. He knew his peril a moment later, for his enemy's head resembled a four-tentacled octopus. Dritz had never actually viewed such a creature before, but he knew what it was. An Illithid, a mind flayer, the most evil and most feared monster in all of the Underdark.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And my name is Christian Sager. And today we're talking about mind flayers.
That's right.
As you get from that quote, mind flayers, for those of you who aren't aware, we're really diving down the geek well today to get a monster that we both love and grew up with. But this is a creature that was originally created for Dungeons and Dragons, right?
Yeah. It also has a long history that I'm just learning about in the Final Fantasy games. And I imagine other properties as well that were inspired by especially early Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. But so we're not just talking about this because we're into geeky stuff. Right?
That's like 50% of the reason.
Yeah. we're using the mind flayer as a jumping off point to look at some really interesting science, both in biology, but also a little bit in technology today.
Yeah. In the same way that Dritz, our hero, in the opening narration, used that stalactite
exactly.
As a springboard, right?
So that was a quote from R.A. Salvatore's Exile, which is part of the Dark Elf trilogy. It's actually book two in the Dark Elf trilogy. Yeah. You may be familiar with this. If you're not, I'll give you a quick primer. These are Dungeons and Dragons based novels, set in the Forgotten Realms setting, based around this character, Dritz Do'Urden, that is, pretty popular with that crowd.
And still part of the property.
There's
board games that come out. He's mentioned in the materials for the big current Underdark campaign.
I'm pretty sure they're still coming out with novels with him in it too. And these, I have a fondness for these novels because they were like my way to wind down my brain after doing too much research, either when I was in graduate school or sometimes from podcasting. So I've read, I want to say there's like 20, 25 of these books, and I've probably read three quarters of them. mostly I refer to them as sword porn because there's just like whole sections, like pages and pages where it's just describing like the ways in which he moves his swords. I mean, just in this one paragraph alone, like they had to mention like the way he drew his scimitar and everything. But mind flayers are like the primary antagonist in this specific book. So I pulled that quote, and then there's another one later on where I think that this contributed to the lore surrounding them. So, you know, we'll refer back to it.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're using this creature, this wondrous creature as an opportunity to discuss some science. And we're using science as a way to explain some of the more fantastic aspects of this fictional monster. It's kind of a relationship we come back to, time and time again, because as I like to say, no matter how fantastic, how crazy the imagined monster is, you can almost count on nature to have equal or surpassed it in weirdness.
Yeah, that's exactly what's so wonderful about using this for an episode of the show. And I'd like to point out that this is actually connected to two other things that we do on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. The first is obviously Robert's monster science that he's been working on for years. If you go to stufftoblowyourmind.com, there are, I dare say, 100 maybe monster science posts. Like, you've covered almost every monster in existence.
Well, I wouldn't go that far because they're pretty inexhaustible. But yeah, the monster of the week posts are kind of like the monster science versions.
And
of
then there's the video series Monster Science as well, which you can find there, or you can find, well, all the videos are on our Facebook and our YouTube channel as well. But also, you and Joe are doing an episode coordinated with this that's about mind control.
Yeah, it's going to be titled What Mind Control Feels Like, and it should be the episode that follows this. I think this episode right here is coming out on a Thursday, and then the following one, the mind control episode, will come out on a Tuesday, but it'll all come together.
So brace yourselves, everybody. Yeah. We're really getting into it with minds, brains, and actual brain eating today.
Yeah, because one of the things about the mind flayers, if you're not familiar, and if you're not familiar at all with the mind flayers, just bear with us. We'll get to the real science as well. But they are not only these octopus-headed, purple-fleshed evildoers that live in the Underdark, this vast subterranean realm in the Dungeons & Dragons world. They are also psychic or psionically gifted creatures that are able to just dominate people left and right with their amazing psychic powers, you know, throwing mind blasts all over the dungeon, just really wreaking havoc. But that is their primary power.
And their finishing move is to grab a hold of you with their tentacle mouths and suck your brain right out of your head. That's total kill, like instant kill, I think, if you get grappled by a mind flayer by the head or whatever.
You know, they actually, not to skip too far ahead into their anatomy, but they're generally represented as having just four digits on their hand.
Right.
So they have three knuckles. And I was thinking the other day, this would be perfect for a TPK tattoo for mind flayer or total party kill.
That's your thug mind flayer.
Yeah.
I like it.
For those of you not familiar with the game, total party kill is when the creatures in the game, or more specifically, the dungeon master kills off the entire party generally this occurs because the encounter is not mathematically calibrated.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to use these as a jumping off point, and you guys are probably saying to yourselves right now, like, whoa, like this isn't what I signed up for. Just bear with us, because the thing about mind flayers in particular that is really useful for Stuff to Blow Your Mind is they were created for this game, and then it's been a good almost 40 years that people have been working on them, whether it's in these novels that I mentioned earlier, or for rule books, or for video games, or whatever. It's kind of like Star Wars creatures. They've had like more and more tagged on to their fictional biology and culture and philosophy over the years, to the point that it's like it's this fleshed out world, you know, and it's really fascinating what multiple people brought to the table with it and how that then subsequently translates, because they were obviously inspired by, you know, creatures from real life.
Oh, yeah.
Or philosophy in different cultures.
Oh, yeah, indeed. I mean, in so many cases, either the people adding to the mythos of, say, the Mind Flayers, they either were directly inspired by natural world organisms, or their just weird creativity managed to parallel actual natural world weirdness.
That's the, like, somebody needs to do a history of the Mind Flayer creation book, where they talk to all these people, because in front of us here in the studio right now is Volo's Guide to Monsters, and it has a pretty comprehensive, almost 10-page section.
Oh, yeah.
On Mind Flayers. More, I dare say, than real world encyclopedias have on some of the real world animals we're going to talk about in today's episode.
Yeah.
But it's really impressive, and I would love to see how all these pieces came together.
Yeah, and that just came out, by the way, if anyone out there is interested, just published. Now, in terms of, we're not going to attempt to do what we just mentioned here. We're not going to actually, go piece by piece through the generation of the Mind Flayer, but we will just touch on its origins, which go back to Gary Gygax himself, the creator of Dungeons and Dragons.
Indeed, he is the guy. He's the guy who started the whole thing, and you got a nice quote from him here specifically about Mind Flayers.
Yeah, he said, quote, "The Mind Flayer I made up out of whole cloth using my imagination, but inspired by the cover of Brian Lumley's novel in paperback edition, The Burrowers Beneath."
So I've never seen this before. What's it look like?
I looked at the various covers, and the one that I think most modern readers are used to is the one that looks kind of like an eye in the center of a nautilus.
Okay.
And that one looks more Mind Flayery.
Yeah.
But the original cover, the one that I think Gygax would have seen, just kind of looks like a silhouette of dark tentacles rising out of a hill.
Okay.
But still, I take the man at his word. Lumley, of course, was Lovecraft influenced.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a lot of Lovecraftian weirdness to the Mind Flayers. So just as the fictional race has crossed over from another realm in Dungeons and Dragons, the very inception is sort of a cross-pollination from a different dimension of literary fantasy.
Yeah, I think you could probably trace their origins all the way back to Lovecraft's intense fear of sea life.
So, and just to get this out of the way too, because again, I know a number of you may be primarily familiar with these critters from Final Fantasy or other properties. Illithid is definitely a D&D property.
Oh yeah, right. But they've got the TM on that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, so you can't just throw Illithids around in other games or video games or novels without Big Dungeon getting a cut. But Mind Flayers you'll see elsewhere.
Yeah, right. In fact, we saw there was a paper that you found that's stunning, all about the various types of sort of cephalopod monster mollusks that show up in video games.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's an article that was published in Geek Studies.
Yeah,
and I'll try to include a link to that on the landing page for this episode. But it's, just all about weird squid and octopus monsters from 16-bit video games.
And there was this amazing chart of all of the various ones, and it, down to their little 8-bit renderings, and there's the Mind Flayer, very recognizable in there. So yeah, again, these are basically purple people with octopus heads. Their mouths are like lampreys. We're going to go through the anatomy pretty carefully because that's how we're going to tie it into real world science.
That's right. All right. So let's dive in. Let's talk about their origins real quick, which are, of course, shrouded in mystery. So there are basically two origin stories in play here. Most likely, the Mind Flayers hail from the Far Realm, which is an alien dimension of cosmic horror in the D&D universe. But there's also this whispered rumor that they're from the future, and perhaps even the distant, highly evolved state of humanoid life in the multiverse. Though I'm not sure much stock is actually put in that interpretation.
I want to say that's the one that's heavily Lovecraft influenced, because there's, and I can't believe I can't remember the name of the monster from one of Lovecraft's short stories, but that's one of the things from his, that this monster is from the future and it's come back in time to sort of right some wrong or something like that. And I think, this is, again, there's no sources behind this, but if my memory is correct from playing D&D for 20 some odd years, their origin story differs depending on which setting you're playing D&D in, right?
Well, that's right. It's a multiverse. And, yeah. and of course, they also instill this in you. Your game is not necessarily taking place in the same
right.
corner of the multiverse as the campaign across the road.
Yeah. 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 Exactly.
So one of the really important plot points with the Illithids is that in ages past, they carved out an enormous empire for themselves, one that spanned whole worlds in the material plane as well as other various planes. They had slash have spaceships called Nautiloids that enable travel across the planes, but they've lost the technology of their manufacture. Like any decent elder race, they've
right.
forgotten how to
so
redo.
They're kind of like relics rabies. Now.
Yeah. But they built their empire mostly on the back of psionically dominated slave labor. But after time, as, happens when you build your empire on slave labor, the slaves, rose up, they rebelled, and, their empire fell to pieces. And so they had to go out and just sort of find little corners to survive. And in particular, they end up taken up in the Underdark. And here they end up, having more slave races, and each one they mess up by just psionically dominating them,
yeah.
altering them, changing them into whatever form suits the mind flayers, and just causing lots of trauma and mischief just across the world.
They remind me kind of this ant that we've covered on the show before. I'm going to have trouble remembering its Latin name off the top of my head, but you might know it. Cordyceps?
Oh yes, the cordyceps fungi that end up growing in the ants.
Yeah,
the brains.
Exactly. Yeah. So this fungi gets inside these ant brains, and it sort of controls them to take care of its fungal colony and allow it to take the ant resources. And mind flayer, I guess sociology is mm-hmm. somewhat similar in that they dominate these, people of various D&D species, dwarves, elves, human beings, whatever,
mm-hmm.
Gith.
Oh yeah, the Gith. I'll have to touch on the Gith here.
And they're the slaves that sort of like work and do all the labor for the mind flayers. They even, one of the things that the slaves are known to do is they have to scrub down the elder brain and massage it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And the elder brain's important too. That's the thing. All these different elements we're touching on here, they might sound a bit like fluff, but we're going to come back to them
yeah.
and discuss some science around them. But real quick about the Gith were the biggest mistake that they made.
Right.
These were the thralls that really rose up and not only helped bring about the fall of their empire, but now the Gith regularly venture out from their astral plane headquarters to hunt down and eradicate Illithid colonies wherever they can find them. And that's one of the key reasons that Illithids live in the safety and secret of the Underdark or other secluded places in each separate colonies cut off from all the others while they calculate and scheme and figure out how they're going to restore their empire.
Right. Yeah. So they basically like live in these like deep caves. It's almost like an ant colony.
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
It's all based around the center of this elder brain I mentioned earlier, which we're going to get into. They kind of like occasionally just go out, grab some slaves, pull them back in, and like that's how their society runs.
Yeah. It's going to be very helpful as we go forward just to think of them as eusocial parasites.
Yes. Really, like, they have two options. They either capture somebody and eat their brain mm-hmm. or capture them and dominate their mind and make them into a slave.
Right.
So either way, an encounter with a mind flayer is going to end up bad.
All right. So let's launch into their biology. Again, bipedal humanoid bodies, 4 tentacles, 4 clawed digits per hand. Diet consists mostly of psionic energy with some additional sustenance from the gobble brains themselves. Now, technically speaking, they're troglophiles. They're cave-dwelling creatures that complete their life cycles in a cave, but they can also survive above ground.
Now, help me out with this. Troglophiles is a real term.
Yeah, yeah. This is a real term. This is not a Dungeons & Dragons term.
Yeah.
This would be the natural world classification for a creature like this.
Right.
Though, of course, classifications are difficult when you're considering even fictional intelligent creatures, one that is choosing to live underground in a subterranean environment for their own purposes.
And now their reproductive system is utterly bizarre. And yet, there are real world examples that are almost as bizarre.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are real world examples. When you start looking at complex life cycles, yeah. you look at some of the parasite life cycles out there and various insect life cycles that are not only just like a bizarre circle of parasitic behavior, but also when you see branches in the tree, and this is key to understanding the mind flayers, when you see various morphs that can emerge.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, walk us through this.
All right, so you have an egg. That's where it starts, an elithid egg.
An adult mind flayer. What came first? The mind flayer or the egg? No, an adult mind flayer lays an egg?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so they lay an egg. That egg hatches into an elithid tadpole.
Right.
So a little squirming, a tadpole, a little larval elithid. Now, from that point, there are a few different things that can happen. Ideally, there's a process called seramorphosis. And this is where adult mind flayers would come and pick up the little tadpole and implant it in the cranium of a captive humanoid, mm-hmm. like a captive kind of like psychically washed humanoid.
And they usually put it through the ear, but there's a drawing in Volo's Guide of Monsters of like, it's very based on Wrath of Khan of like the tadpole like crawling its way up the face toward the eye socket of a victim.
Yeah. So yeah, that exact scenario. So one way or another, they get that puppy into the brain, and then it eats the brain, replaces the brain, and then that host body becomes the new mind flayer body. It turns purple, slimy, loses a digit on each hand,
gets pretty skinny.
Yeah, and then you got yourself an adult elithid that carries on adult elithid business.
Yeah, and eventually can go on to lay eggs of its own.
Right. Now there are two other possible ways that this can go with the elithid tadpole. So sometimes the elithid becomes a eulitharid. And this is essentially a super mind flayer that is going to eventually leave the colony with some other mind flayers, found a new colony, okay. and become its elder brain.
Okay, so it doesn't have humanoid form. It's just like the super-powered tadpole?
Right. It's a super-powered tadpole. Still has to be implanted into a humanoid, but
gotcha.
It's destined to be this seeder of a new colony.
And it will eventually grow into a giant brain.
Right, once it establishes itself elsewhere.
Gotcha.
And then the other way that things can go is the elithid tadpole can become a neolithid. And this is when nobody's taking care of the tadpoles. No mind flayers are coming around to look after them and make sure they're stuffed into the right skull. In this case, they all freak out and start eating each other. And whichever one is left grows into a giant, powerful beast intelligence monster.
Huh. Okay. I have never encountered one of these before.
This is good. It's like a level 13.
Wow. Okay.
But what's going on with both of these cases, and this is where there's a real world parallel that we'll break down a little more in a bit, is that you essentially have two morphs springing off from the tadpole. One is caused by negative environmental constraints, and that leads to the neolithid,
right.
and the other is positive environmental constraints, which leads to the eulitharid.
So I'm assuming this is dependent on like how many humanoids are available for them to eat brains of, or make slaves into, or whatnot. Right?
Yeah,
how big the cave system is that they're living within, etc.
Yeah, it has to do with population density in our real world examples that we'll get to. So
yeah.
you can think of it in those terms: like is the colony successful enough to send off anything to found a new colony, or is it even successful enough for the tadpoles to continue to thrive, or should they just all eat each other out of purely economic cannibalism?
Which is a thing that does happen.
Oh yeah, in multiple species.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right, in real species, but also in this fictional one we're talking about, right?
Just in our real world,
cannibalism
is always the most economic path.
Yeah.
to avoid wasting the energy that goes into flesh.
So we've mentioned this elder brain multiple times, and basically I just said it's a giant brain, but let's get a little bit more defined here on this.
Yeah, I mean, essentially it's just a giant brain in a brine pool that is in charge of the mind flayer colony.
See, but in the Dritz books, it's in cerebral fluid. And I always wondered, where did they get all that cerebral fluid from? Like maybe they eat the brains and then they like keep They drain the cerebral fluid out to put in their little elder brain pool that they've got.
No, they just have Amazon weekly deliveries on saline solution.
Oh, that's okay. How they do it. Yeah. Well, the 2-day shipping on Prime.
Yeah, yeah. You got to do it. Even to the Underdark.
Exactly.
Yeah. So according to Volos, what's going on here with the elder brain is this: to survive and to make the necessary meta calculations in order, you know, to actually survive and to eventually reclaim their empire. They've either evolved or developed the elder brains. And these are giant, immobile thought organs that float in tanks of brine, serving as the Mind Flayer's colony's library of knowledge, a history of past lives, and a nexus of metacognition for the individuals in the colony. Okay. And each individual then is going to employ non-Illithid thralls as well.
Now, this reminds me of, in the Marvel universe, they have a similar thing, the Kree alien species, which I haven't seen a lot of the TV show Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but I think they show up in there. Mm-hmm. They're ruled by a thing that's very similar to this that's called the Supreme Intelligence. It's kind of the same thing. It's just like a big blob in like a giant canister of cerebral fluid, and it's got some brain tentacles and like eyes and a mouth.
Yeah.
These don't have eyes and a mouth. They're just brains.
No, just big brains.
Yeah.
And they do all sorts of psionically powerful tactics against anybody that threatens them. But we'll come back to the elder brains in a bit because there are actual parallels to discuss with humans. All right. So that is the crash course in the fictional Illithids. Now, from here on in the episode, we're going to largely focus on what the natural world, what real life biology can tell us about what's going on with the Illithids and how we can use the Illithid example as a way to explore these examples.
Yeah. So the way that I approached this was sort of like, let's Frankenstein from the real world a mind flayer out of what we know of how they're described, right?
Right.
So their biology, anatomy, all that stuff. Like, what's in the real world that we can bring to our understanding of this? And the first place that I went to was their mouths, because they are described as, even though they've got these tentacles, they're described as their specific mouths as being like lamprey mouths. Lampreys, if you're unfamiliar, are jawless fish. They've got these thorny suction cup like mouths, and they are parasites, much like the mind flayers and a lot of the creatures we're going to talk about today. They use their mouths to attach to an animal's body, and then they cut with these teeth through surface tissue until they reach the blood and bodily fluids of it. They're known to live in both coastal and fresh water. They look like eels, kind of, but they're not. They're fish. There's three types of them. There's flesh eaters, blood drinkers, and just a type that lives for 3 to 7 years in a larval stage. And then they only live for 6 months as adults, but they don't really feed. They just reproduce with other lampreys and then they die. So an equally weird example from the real world. Now, there is an excellent article on Wired from 2014 called Absurd Creature of the Week, the Lamprey, that just really dove deep into the lamprey's biology. So I turned to that for a real deep description of this mouth. What's going on with this mouth? Now, flesh eater lampreys and blood drinker lampreys have different types of mouths. So let's go with the flesh eater for today, since we know that the mind flayer is definitely using it to eat brains. So they have a structure that's like a tongue. These are lampreys, and it's called a piston. It has this convex structure to it that moves both side to side and up and down, basically gouging flesh out of its victim with a strong middle tooth attached to it. And this middle tooth is shaped like a U in the flesh eater lampreys and like a W in the blood drinker lampreys. And for different reasons, one's better at like pulling flesh into the mouth. The other is better for getting blood flowing.
Gotcha.
And they're very much like other animals that we've talked about when we've covered vampires on the show before. They have glands in their throat that secrete an anticoagulant, and that helps keep the blood flowing, help get stuff down their throat. In the flesh eaters, the anticoagulant glands are much smaller, but they still exist. So presumably a mind flayer would have some kind of anticoagulant gland as well. Now, lampreys have two rings of structures inside the mouth that helps them adhere to their victims through suction. One ring is the oral fimbriae, and it basically looks like little leaves that are made of flaps of tissue. And these adhere closely to the skin of the victim, and they form this tight seal. Like, I mean, I've never been bitten by a lamprey, but I imagine, like, from what I've heard, they're next to impossible to get off of you. Like, part of the country that I lived in for a while in New Hampshire was right next to what was called the Lamprey River. And so, obviously, there are a lot of freshwater lampreys in there. I never encountered them. But, you know, my understanding is, like, you know, you have to basically kill it to get it off and then have it, I think, surgically removed. So it's clamped on there tight. There's a second ring in the mouth that is made of conical structures known as papillae. And these help the lamprey actually sense where best to attach themselves. So the blood drinking lampreys, they're so sensitive with this region of their mouth that they can actually use it to find underlying blood vessels in their victims. So this is like, think of it as like radar almost, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's a super sensitive organ built into their mouth so they can find the best possible place to clamp down and start chewing and sucking blood or flesh out of you. Now, they don't often go after humans. Don't be listening to this and like freak out and say, oh boy, like that, you know, that's pretty rare. I think it has happened obviously, but fun fact that Joe actually told me about, I was talking to him about this episode before we came to the studio and he said, well, did you know, this is classic Joe. He's got just like this ample amount of weird knowledge. He goes, did you know Henry the First died from eating a pie full of lampreys? And I was like, what? What are you talking about?
Like a lamprey pie?
Yeah. And he was right. Apparently King Henry the First died from food poisoning when he ate what was referred to as a surfeit of lampreys in a pie. Huh. His physician specifically told him not to. He was like, this is a bad idea. And I think he was like 68, 69. He was, mm-hmm. you know, for the time, quite elderly. But he was like, nope, I'm eating this pie full of lampreys. I can't imagine what that tastes like. It just made me immediately nauseous when Joe told me about it. But by all accounts, there's multiple pieces of evidence that this guy ate a lamprey pie.
Well, we'll have to hear from people who have a culinary experience with lampreys.
Yeah, maybe they taste great. I don't know. I can't imagine that a creature that solely subsists on just like hanging onto the body of its victim and draining it of blood has got like a lot of like, you know, good fatty flesh on it for eating. But I'm also a vegetarian.
Now, for the Mind Flayers part, of course, it's not so much about blood or meat. It's about getting that brain.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess the idea here would be if we looked at the lamprey, it would be to either use some sort of specialized tongue after attachment to either like cut its way through an eye socket or some other natural fleshy gateway to the brain.
The way I've always,
or just like straight through the skull.
Yeah, the way I've always seen it drawn is from behind. Like the mind flayer tentacles wrap around your face from behind. The mouth attaches to the back of your skull, and then presumably this piston thing is in their mouth and just bores through your skull, and subsequently they just chunk your brain up and suck it up through their mouth. Hmm. Yeah, leaving you with a head without a brain.
All right. Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we will explore more horrifying wonders related to the elithid body as well as natural world organisms. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, it's Danielle, Will, and Ryder from Pod Meets World. Thanks to our friends at Hyundai, we were able to record a very special episode for you guys at the one and only, wait for it,
Boy Meets World House.
Take a listen.
We are lucky to be sitting with Alan and Amy Matthews in the flesh, William, Rusty Russ, and Betsy Randall.
Yay!
Thank you. Woo! Thank you.
Yes.
When those legends get here, let me know.
You're here. You're here already.
We didn't either when we were watching this.
That's the thing. That's
we didn't
the problem.
Realize it until we started getting into seasons 3 and 4. And now we're like, oh my God.
You were both so good on the show, and we missed it because we were young.
We were kids and so self involved.
Egomaniacs. Yeah. And didn't realize how great you were.
We've talked about it. I think you just assumed everybody was as good as them. And,
right.
and then
right.
you get into, right. as you grow up and you work with other actors, you realize how lucky we were to have you guys.
This has been brought to you by the fully electric Hyundai Ioniq 5. New episode out now. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Okay, so we're back. Robert, you had previously mentioned the possibilities of tadpoles in real life and in Mind Flayer life being cannibals.
Yes.
So let's talk about this.
All right. So once more, again, according to Volo's Guide to Monsters, an illithid lays eggs in protected pools in larval tadpole hatcheries. All right. The tadpoles hatch, and then they get turned into adult Mind Flayers. Now, tadpoles in abandoned pools, these are pools that, you know, the Mind Flayers that looked after were all slain by high-level adventurers or Gith coming in from the outside.
Right.
So there's nobody to take care of them. So what they do is they end up eating each other until all you have left is just one mutated survivor known as a neolithid. And this just grows into a monstrous psychic worm that's a danger to illithids and non-illithids alike. Large, powerful, animal-minded monster with some psionic ability.
Okay, so there are some real-world examples of this, right?
Yeah. For the real-world parallel here would be tiger salamander cannibal morphs.
Okay.
So the life cycle of the tiger salamander features an interesting developmental fork. An egg can develop into a normal larval tadpole or into this cannibal morph. See, now under normal circumstances, tiger salamander eggs develop into normal tadpoles and then into normal adult tiger salamanders. But if the population is too large for the available environment, so like they're in a small pool or something, then consistent tactile interactions with other tadpoles cause some of the eggs to develop into tadpoles with larger heads, bigger mouths, and more well-developed teeth.
I'm definitely picturing like a baby xenomorph.
Yeah. So yeah, it's basically the scenario is not to personify non-human, non-intelligent relationships here, but it's almost like there's somebody in charge that says, all right, we got too many salamanders in this pool. Let's just make one that's really good at eating all the other salamanders. So basically they have a built-in population control system, larva on larva cannibalism. If the brood pool is overcrowded and the resources are too scarce, then some tadpoles physically transform in order to better gobble up the others.
That is absolutely terrifying. Let's back up for a second here. let's apply this to human beings. Imagine there's a nursery and it's, at the hospital and it's got all the babies in their little beds, right?
Yeah.
And one baby grows a little bit larger. Its head gets bigger. It gets this huge mouth and it grows well-developed teeth. And then it proceeds to crawl around the nursery and eat some of the other babies.
Yeah.
That's basically what we're talking
about.
That's
the basic scenario here. Yeah.
Now, wow.
and after this culling is done, the cannibal morph salamander, it keeps its large head and bigger mouth, but then goes through, its diet normalizes and it goes through a normal life cycle.
I'm trying to imagine like the animal documentary that's narrated by like Morgan Freeman or Sigourney Weaver or something. And they're like, and here we have the tiger salamander eating all of its fellow tadpole babies. And it's just like,
well, that's exactly the kind of thing Attenborough would hit us with.
Yeah, Attenborough would love it. That's true.
And I would have to immediately skip the track for my son as we watch nature shows. Now let's turn to the Neolithid. So yeah, the Neolithid, you can look at it and say, this is essentially a cannibal morph. This is one tadpole eating all the other tadpoles and then growing into this giant thing. So if we're to use nature as our guide here, we can only assume that the Neolithid morph once served an evolutionary purpose, allowing a tadpole pool to survive in times of chaos or abandonment, absorbing the nutrients of its fellow tadpoles with just pure economic ruthlessness, just like the cannibal morphs of tiger salamanders. However, with the mind flayers, you can definitely say that the Neolithid is something of a vestigial thing, right? Because there's no information in any of the books I looked at that let us know that the Neolithid continues the Elithid race in any way, shape, or form. It's not going to develop into, as far as I can tell, it's not going to develop into an adult mind flayer. So this is perhaps a fitting accident for a species that has manipulated other species and itself for so long. Under normal condition, larger tadpoles would be killed, and they certainly would not be permitted to mature into a Neolithid.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine like in the mind flayer society, this isn't always a good thing, right?
Yeah,
it kind of deviates from your normal routine.
It would be like it would be exactly like if humans could do this,
right?
You would know never always space your babies out. Don't put them too close, or you're going to end up with a cannibal morph baby.
Yeah,
and then what are we going to do about that? You know.
Well, so this isn't directly related to the cannibalism thing, but I found an interesting article about tadpoles that I just wanted to throw in here as well to try to understand the Neolithids. So according to research that was published in 2013, apparently tadpoles can see if you attach eyeballs to their tails.
What?
Now, this is utterly bizarre. Why? What I'm wondering is like, you know, what the working conditions are like in this laboratory. But basically, it was compelling to scientists to study because they wanted to learn how much a tadpole brain could interpret sensory data. So they took the African claw frog Xenopus laevis, I believe that's the Latin pronunciation. They took their tadpoles and they grafted eyeballs onto their torsos and tails, and then they removed their original eyes. So that's the part to me, I'm like, what mad science is this that they're just like plucking eyes out of these creatures and then pasting eyes onto other parts of their body?
Yeah, who's the awful underdark monster here?
Yeah, exactly. This is the kind of thing mind flayers do.
Yeah.
Then they gave a tadpole vision test. And the way that they did this was they illuminated half the area that the tadpoles were in with red light and half with blue light. And in the red light, the tadpoles would get electrocuted. They'd get zapped with electricity. So again, more torture, right? Mm-hmm. We've already yanked your eyeballs out, pasted them onto your tail. Now we're going to zap you. But apparently some of these tadpoles would go over to the blue light area because they knew that it was safe. So the scientists determined some of them could actually see with their eyeball tails because they stayed in these safe blue areas. So the researchers basically argued this is evidence that the brain in general is remarkably plastic in its configuration for different body arrangements, like especially at tadpole stage when it's so, you know, you're at the beginning of the life cycle. Mm-hmm. It can adapt quickly enough to like somehow rewire so it can attach to these eyeballs that are just not supposed to be there.
Right.
And this is what allows mutations in all kinds of body plans, not just in frogs and tadpoles, to still work with the existing anatomy. So the basic idea here is like if there's some kind of a mutation in a single organism, it can adapt quickly, or its brain can adapt quickly because like it's designed to be so, I don't know, flexible, literally. Huh.
Well, that's wonderful because this not only gives us a little more information about tadpoles and how they work, but again, it shows, it supports the theory that mind flayers are essentially us.
Yeah, very much so. And I think, right, like, can you imagine there, here's your D&D campaign, right? You're some adventurers, you have to sneak into a mind flayer cave, take some of their tadpoles and then pull their eyes off and reattach them to their tails and perform this experiment in D&D time. So we'll see what kind of odd results that would have.
Now we're talking about brain eating monsters here. So one of the most obvious areas to explore here would be what animals eat brains. And it's a trickier scenario than we often think because there are plenty of animals that eat brains. Humans eat brains.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, this is going to have forever scarred me, but growing up, did you ever see Faces of Death?
No, I mean, I'm very familiar with them by reputation.
Yeah, you're lucky that you didn't, but there was, one of the like bootlegged VHS copies that I saw back when I was, God, must have been like 14 or 15 years old. Mm-hmm. They did the thing where they put the monkey in the middle of a table. The table has like the circular entry and you hit the monkey on the head, open up its skull and people eat the brains. It's a delicacy.
This would be the very thing that was referenced in that awful scene in the second Indiana Jones movie. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And if you wonder why I'm a vegetarian, that was probably the beginnings of it right there.
Yeah. God, what an odd, I want to go back and watch that movie sometimes, but
don't.
There's so much weird xenophobic material.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, ugh. Yeah. I feel sorry if our listeners are out there and you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there are a lot of examples, plenty of animals, birds, humans that eat brains, right? But to understand the mind flayer effect on, the humanoids that they're eating the brains of, I turn to a couple specific creatures that I think will help us out here.
Yeah, because one of the things about the mind flayer is that, you know, in a very fantasy way, it eats psychic energy. And of course, there are no real parallels to that in the real world. Otherwise, they're definitely eating the brain and nothing else. So the way to describe this in biology would be to say that they're obligate, I guess, neurovores.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to find anything like that in biology.
Yeah.
But you have a couple possibilities here.
I do. Yeah. All of them much smaller than the mind flayer. The first is, and again, help me with my Latin here. I think it's Naegleria fowleri. This is referred to in English as the brain eating amoeba.
Ooh.
And this amoeba is the primary cause of the infectious disease amoebic meningoencephalitis, which is also referred to as just PAM, P-A-M. The amoeba can exist in different kinds of environments, sometimes in soil, sometimes in freshwater, and that's where it becomes trouble for us as human beings. Or it can exist in the human central nervous system. Now, these infections are really rare. What we're about to tell you, like, don't get super freaked out. It's incredibly rare. But when they happen, 95 to 99% of the time, it's fatal. Like if you get one of these amoeba in you, you're pretty much done for.
This is rolling a one on your skill check.
Yeah. The CDC actually estimates that there were 138 cases of PAM reported in the United States between 1962 and 2015. Okay. So that gives you an idea of how rare it is. Of those, only 3 of the patients survived. So how do you get it? You're all probably immediately going, oh, what? I don't want that. How do I stay away from that? Well, usually it's from engaging in recreational water activities like swimming or diving. So, you know, you'd basically have to stay away from water fun if you want to totally avoid this thing. The amoeba enters, the human body through your nose and it attaches itself to the epithelial cells that line the inside of the nasal cavity. Then it migrates to the nerves that are situated in the nasal area. Eventually, this reaches the central nervous system of your spinal cord and brain, and it induces your body's immune system to activate macrophages and neutrophils to combat infection. Doesn't feel good, and here's why. The amoeba itself, this is very mind flayery. It has food cups on its surface that allow it to capture its own food resources. And this is everything from bacteria and fungi to human tissue if it's gotten up your nose. In addition, it produces cell-destructive molecules that destroy the membrane structure of nerve cells. So the combination of these two things make it really effective at inducing severe nerve damage. It eventually will destroy your entire central nervous system. This makes them a pretty serious public health hazard, because they can be easily acquired. You know, you're just swimming along, you get one up your nose and boom. And then they're associated with this really high mortality rate. Now, the symptoms don't show up until about 2 to 8 days after infection. And they include the following. And this is, I think we can use these as probably an idea of what symptoms would be like of either being under the thrall of mind flayers or during the process of your brain being consumed.
Okay. So as they're sucking that brain out, just beginning to suck it out, I guess.
So sudden headache. That's an obvious one, right? High fever, neck pain, nausea, vomiting, rhinitis, light sensitivity, and eventually seizures and a coma. So, all right, mind flayer is probably doing this much quicker than the brain-eating amoeba is, right? But that's a basic idea.
You know, unless they have different culinary styles, you know?
Yeah, maybe there's some of them, maybe they like to eat slow.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading that supposedly some mind flayers experiment by, say, subjecting their victims to, you know, musical thoughts or whatever. Like they'll want a certain mind state before they eat it because it adjusts the flavor.
Better.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So they go to a special school to like learn what specific thoughts to beam into the brain before they eat it.
Yeah. Do you want your brain meal to be more like a veal?
Right.
Do you want it to be a sushi? You know, depends.
Huh. Well, again, I want to remind everybody, the brain-eating amoeba is pretty rare. It's so rare that no clinical trials for developing treatments even exist as of 2016. Usually, if it's found, it's treated with something called amphotericin B, which is an antifungal drug, as well as a variety of other antifungal drugs. And I've got some examples for you. In fact, these are the 3 survivors in the U.S. There's been 7 survivors in the whole world, 3 in the U.S. One of them was a 9-year-old girl in California who was infected in 1978, and she caught it by swimming in Deep Creek Hot Springs in San Bernardino National Forest. She was treated with exactly what I just described. They gave her amphotericin B, some other antifungal drugs intravenously, and she beat it and lived through the experience. Now, 2 other children were reported survivors of this just in 2013, so just 3 years ago, and they were 12 and 8 years old. And the 12-year-old first contracted it at a water park that was near Little Rock, Arkansas. So don't think to yourself like, oh, this is only if I swim in like natural water.
Right.
Apparently they got it at this water park as well. In addition to the antifungal treatments that they usually give, this girl was so bad off that they had to subject her to induced hypothermia to reduce her brain swelling. So this is a pretty nasty disease. But also, you know, let's keep it in mind when we're thinking about, boy, this mind flayer, it's got its lamprey mouth attached and its piston drilling through my head. What's that going to feel like?
So this would be an example of a creature that certainly doesn't depend on human brains at all.
Exactly.
But this is it. But it also gives us an example of what brain eating in the real world consists of.
Yep. We have a couple other examples here, too. The next one is neurocysticercosis, which is a type of tapeworm that usually lives in pigs. This is very stuff to blow your mind. You must have covered
the pork tapeworm.
Yeah.
Right?
Pork tapeworm produce larvae that can latch onto cranium, whether it's a pig's cranium or human cranium, and they show up as large white cysts. They usually disperse through a pig's bloodstream. So when you're eating undercooked pork, you could be eating their larva. So when they enter a human, usually from eating undercooked pork, they still flow through our bloodstream and they get stuck inside the fluid-filled cavities in our brains. These can lead to a coma, loss of motor functions, violent seizures, or blindness. And the reason why? They're eating holes into your brain.
Now, my understanding of this scenario is that essentially you have a parasite that is lost in an unfamiliar host.
Exactly, yeah. And it's just doing what it thinks it's supposed to do, and it results in this. Yeah. Now, it's unlike the amoeba, this is more common than you might think. It's estimated that 2,000 people have them in the U.S. and 29 million in Latin America.
Now, these are just pork tapeworms going about their regular business, not necessarily getting lost or winding up in the brain, though.
Yeah, I believe that's true. Yeah, which can be right. It can subsequently lead to that. The other one that's related to this, similar effect, very different being, is prion disease. And we've talked about this occasionally on the show. Prions, there are a variety of fatal neurological illnesses that are associated with them. They are abnormal proteins, and you can both inherit them or have them transmitted into your body through infected animal tissue. They result in symptoms of dementia or ataxia, which is impaired motor control, and they eventually lead to death, and it can take anywhere from weeks to months. You might have heard of this as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. There's also new variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, Kuru, Gerstmann-Strasser-Scheinker syndrome, and fatal familial insomnia. So all of these are caused by prion proteins in the brain.
Yeah, Kuru in particular is the one that is associated with traditional acts of funeral cannibalism in certain parts of the world.
Oh, right. Yeah. Exactly.
In Papua New Guinea, I believe.
It leads to disease. Yeah. So all of us are probably most familiar with these from the animal form that we referred to as mad cow disease. It's caused by a similar thing with prions. Now, we've known about this in sheep and goats for hundreds of years. It's referred to as scrappy in sheep and goats. But we didn't know that it was actually transmittable until the 1930s. So basically what happens here is these diseases are caused by proteins that are misshapen. That's why we refer to them as prions. They clump together and proliferate by inducing shape changes in our normal proteins. And this causes sponge-like lesions in the brain that disrupt brain function. So there's your three examples. You got the prions, the pork tapeworm, and the brain-eating amoeba. Basically, you know, very different kinds of creatures that can get into your nervous system and wreak havoc. But good examples of probably what's going on with mind flayer consumption.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to compare the elithids to a certain tongue-eating parasite.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left, look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, it's Danielle, Will, and Ryder from Pod Meets World. Thanks to our friends at Hyundai, we were able to record a very special episode for you guys at the one and only, wait for it,
Boy Meets World House.
Take a listen.
We are lucky to be sitting with Alan and Amy Matthews in the flesh, William, Rusty Russ, and Betsy Randall.
Yay!
Thank you. Woo! Thank you.
Yes.
When those legends get here, let me know.
You're here. You're here already.
We didn't either when we were watching this.
That's the problem.
We didn't realize it until we started getting into seasons 3 and 4. And now we're like, oh, my God.
You were both so good on the show. And we missed it because we were young.
We were kids and so self-involved.
Egomaniacs. Yeah. And didn't realize how great you were.
We've talked about it. I think you just assumed everybody was as good as them. And,
right.
and then
right.
you get into, right. as you grow up and you work with other actors, you realize how lucky we were to have you guys.
This has been brought to you by the fully electric Hyundai Ioniq 5. New episode out now. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
So we talked about this earlier, but the creation of the Mind Flayer in its, I guess, lore throughout the last 40 some odd years is so amazing that they've actually come up with a detailed process with its own title called seramorphosis, which is basically the idea of how it reproduces parasitically, right?
Right. Yeah, it's that example we talked about earlier. The little tadpole is shoved up into the cranium, and then it eats the host brain, and then it attaches there to the brain stem, swells up, grows into the new brain for this body, and then transforms the body.
Now, here's a nerdy little bit that I remember about illithids. Sometimes when they do this, they take on, like, mental tics from the host that they grow within. And this is considered like social flaw. It's like it's a real like bad sign of manners in mind flayer society. So they try to hide it from the rest of their species. So like, let's say like, all right, we'll use Joe as an example. Let's say Joe, has like a tic where he picks at his fingernails.
Okay.
And then, they insert a mind flayer tadpole into Joe. It eats his brain. It turns Joe into a mind flayer, regrows as his brain, but it may still have that tic where it picks at its fingernails, but it has to hide it constantly from other mind flayers or else they'll be like, oh, there's something off with you. You're not mind flayery enough. You didn't discard, the human shell that you're using.
So it's sort of like you're weak because you're in a sense you're letting your clothing control who you
are. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So you're probably wondering, well, this sounds just monstrous and awful and otherworldly. What possible parallel is there? Well, there's a wonderful one and in the form of Psammothea exigua.
Oh, yeah. This is a Stuff to Blow Your Mind classic. We talked about this one on the strain episode.
Yeah. This is the tongue eating isopod.
You might be familiar with these from a movie that came out a couple years ago. It's a found footage horror movie called The Bay.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think the premise, I watched it a while ago, but the premise was something like there was some kind of pollutant in the waters mm-hmm. around this coastal town. It caused the isopods to mutate. And so they started infecting human beings instead of fish.
Yeah. Now, luckily, they don't actually affect humans.
Right.
But there hasn't been a lot of new research published on these creatures. They're quite rare. They're possibly popping up more these days due to overfishing. But essentially what you have here, this is the scenario as we understand it. This little crustacean sneaks in through the gills of a fish. It sets up shop on the host's taste buds. And then there's only so much room in a fish mouth. So you can imagine what the louse's first meal is. It has a tasty helping of tongue juice. Starts sucking on that tongue juice. And once the louse drains the tongue of enough blood, it attaches itself to the atrophied stump of the tongue and essentially becomes the new tongue for the fish. Mm-hmm. And every time the host opens his mouth for a meal, the louse, helps itself to a little food on the way down.
Yeah, you can easily find a Google image search of what these things look like. There's plenty of pictures of people prying fish mouths open, and you can see the little isopod inside.
Peeking out.
Yeah, every time I show my wife it, she just goes, like, she does the voice of the isopod saying, like, hello! Like, it's just peeking out from inside this fish mouth. Fun fact, not these specific isopods that it regrow as tongues, but other isopods can grow to be over 2.5 feet long. And these aren't the tongue replacers, as I said. These are the kind that scavenge the carcasses of whales, which we've talked about before the show as well. Yeah. So these are really, I don't know how to describe isopods verbally on the show, but they're real creepy looking critters, and just imagine them crawling along the corpse of a whale, just slowly chewing their way through it.
Yeah. To drag in another fictional comparison, they remind me a lot of the Gartham from The Dark Crystal, the big beetle creature.
Oh, That's good. Yeah. That's a good example.
So with Psammothia exigua, you have a creature here that mainly, sucks on tongue juice, attaches itself to the stump, while the elithid tadpole goes far beyond that. The elithid tadpole is replacing the central organ of the nervous system. And it's quite appropriate to think of this as an act that just kills the host, but it really serves as a sort of parasitism.
Right.
The body continues to live, albeit in a different form, and many natural world parasites inflict behavioral and physical changes on their hosts. It also gives us a rough evolutionary idea of where the elithids came from or would have come from in a natural system, right? Brain replacing parasites that eventually transcend into something greater.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you really think about it, like, they have to, even though, like, mind flayers best operate in the dark and hide in attack, they have to come into contact with other humanoid species, because otherwise they're just going to only exist as tadpole form.
Right. They have to use humans for bodies. They have to use humans for food. Mm-hmm. Because you can think of it this way. So the parasitic form that goes inside the host is physically eating the brain from the inside out.
Right.
But then as adults, they have to crack open skulls and get brains, in a different way.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. I wonder what happens if a mind flayer eats a prion infected brain.
That would be an interesting plot point. Mm. Infected brains. Mm-hmm. And how maybe they can detect them and know not to eat them.
Maybe that's it. That's like it's like in Alien 3 when the aliens don't attack Sigourney Weaver, because spoilers, she's got one of them in her. But like the mind flayers will like kill everybody except for one person. And it's because they can sense that they've got, either prion related disease or like a pork tapeworm or something.
Well, this would be a wonderful plot for anybody out there who's putting together a campaign. Imagine a scenario in which the big threat that the mind flayers are facing, or perhaps the methodology that's being employed by their enemies, is a prion that's being induced to the populations that the mind flayers depend on for food.
Mad mind flayer disease.
Yeah.
All right, but we've got some more biological parallels, specifically with locusts, right?
Yes. So remember the olothard that we mentioned earlier?
Yeah.
This is the super mind flayer. So again, the scenario here is you have tadpoles growing into adult mind flayers. Everything's going like normal. But then there's an exceptional mind flayer adult who starts rivaling the elder brain.
Okay.
You know, they're disagreeing on everything. And finally, the elder brain says, all right, go do your own thing. Take your followers, get out of here, start your own colony. And that's what happens. Seeds a new colony.
Okay.
And again, you can think of this as a morph, a version of the species that's going to go out and found a new colony. Okay. And the best example that I came across to discuss this is that of the desert locust. So desert locust feature both a gregarious and a solitary morph. A gregarious morph arises as a response to population density. It's more adept at flying, so it can get the heck out of that immediate area, go off and help found a new population of desert locusts.
Okay.
So I think that's what we have here with the elithids. You have a model that closely resembles morphs that develop due to population density in order to spread out and establish new communities. So in this case, it's the idea there's enough of them around that it means that the population is healthy.
Yeah.
The resources are abundant enough and the colony can actually, depart, splinter and form new populations of the species.
Now, what's inherent about that, especially for these mind flayers, is that they're hermaphrodites. So they don't need mates in order to create more mind flayers. So I was thinking about this. I was like, all right, hermaphroditic reproduction is definitely a real thing, but let's look to another example to try to figure out how that would work with mind flayers. And the one I turned to was C. elegans, which is a type of nematode, roundworm or threadworm. And it lives in the soil, usually sometimes rotting vegetation, and it basically feeds on bacteria. And they're very primitive, but we human beings study them a lot. And why? Because they share essential characteristics with human biology. So, you know, they're great for studying the effects of certain things on without doing it to humans or, I don't know, ferrets, which are another sort of, I guess, if you're thinking about it in terms of evolved life forms higher up the chain that has human characteristics. Except some of C. elegans are self-fertilizing hermaphrodites, just like the mind flayers are. And the way that they do this is they cleave embryonically. So I would assume this is something that happens in the mind flayer. It proceeds through morphogenesis and then they grow into an adult. Now, we've been told by Volo's Guide of Monsters that mind flayers lay an egg, but this is all right. Not trying to be gross here, but I'm trying to figure this out, right? You go through seramorphosis, changes your body, turns your head into an octopus. Presumably, it creates some kind of orifice that you can lay an egg through.
Yeah, I would guess so. Or it's utilizing an existing orifice in some way, shape, or form.
Okay. But I'm wondering if maybe what's happening is it's because creating its own eggs, it's cleaving embryonically inside of itself, laying that as an egg, and then that egg hatches, proceeds through morphogenesis, and then goes through the seramorphosis procedure that we've already described, right? Now, C. elegans also has only male counterparts. So there's hermaphrodites and there's males, but there aren't females. It's kind of fascinating. Most of their volume, when you look at their anatomy, is taken up by their reproductive system. So you'd have to imagine maybe mind flayers would be the same way. Like other than the big head, everything from the neck down is reproductive system.
Yeah, I mean, they probably don't need much in the way of a traditional digestive system because they're only getting a limited amount of sustenance out of that brain.
Yeah.
And then who knows how they defecate. Maybe they're always covered in slime. So maybe they just
secrete it through their pores. Yeah. Well, the C. elegans, of their 959 cells, 300 of them are neurons. This sounds about right for a larval mind flayer, especially if it's, you know, primarily using its thoughts, its brain, its thinking capacity. C. elegans also have neural structures. These are just in nematodes, mind you, that include sense organs for taste, smell, temperature, and touch. They don't have eyes, but they do respond to light. Hopefully nobody starts sewing eyes onto these guys anytime soon. But they're responsive to light as well. And they move by flexing and relaxing their dorsal ventral waves along their body to propel themselves along. And this was how I was imagining the mind flayer larvae must have to have some kind of locomotion, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's moving through cerebral fluid that it's swimming around in, or it's crawling up into somebody's skull. So it probably does a similar thing, right? By flexing and relaxing until it burrows up in there and eats the brain. So I think C. elegans as a nematode is a pretty good start. There's lots of hermaphroditic creatures out there that we could look to, but this seems plausible for how the mind flayer, I guess, the reproductive part inside the actual adult mind flayer's body is working.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's an interesting spin on it, and certainly fleshes out something that, at least in the guides I've looked at, they don't really put a lot of detail into.
Right, yeah, that's probably a little too much for your average D&D reader.
That's in Volo's additional guide, the Midnight Guide.
Volo's erotic guide to monsters. okay. So we've talked a lot about this on the side, but let's really get into it. The elder brain. So can you imagine, like, if we just had rather than like, a boss at mm-hmm. work, instead where your boss's office is, there's just a big baby pool that's filled with cerebral fluid and a giant brain. And that's what tells you what your duties are for the day.
I'm picturing it right now. Yeah. I mean, I could probably get behind it after a while.
Yeah. Yeah. You could trust an elder brain.
Yeah. I mean, it's the elder brain. Who's going to question the elder brain?
But what?
You?
I certainly wouldn't know, but, Dritzto Erden did. That's a spoiler for that book, Exile. speaking of which, yeah. So this is actually a quote from it. And I'm going to give you a little bit of an idea of from the prose, what they're like. The inside of the giant stone structure was ringed by balconies and spiraling stairways, each level housing several of the mind flayers. But it was the bottom chamber, unadorned and circular, that held the most important being of all, the central brain. Fully 20 feet in diameter, this boneless lump of pulsating flesh tied the mind flayer community together in telepathic symbiosis. The central brain was the composite of their knowledge, the mental eye that guarded their outside chambers, and which had heard the warning cries of the Illithid from the Drow city many miles to the east. To the Illithids of the community, the central brain was the coordinator of their entire existence and nothing short of their god. Thus, only a very few slaves were allowed with this special tower, captives with sensitive and delicate fingers that could massage the Illithid god thing and soothe it with tender brushes and warm fluids.
Oh,
so it's a little insight into what goes on with the elder brains.
Well, you got to keep the elder brain well scrubbed.
Yeah, yeah. It's like constantly like at a day spa.
Yeah. So again, you get back into this idea that either they developed this over time or they evolved to have the elder brain as part of their biology, essentially, but part of their life cycle. I tend to like the idea that they developed it or they turned to it after the fall, because the mind flayers endlessly plot the restoration of their empire. And to do so, they have to maintain a perfect balance of secrecy and exploration, ever clawing out the shortest, safest path, much like the Spacing Guild in the Dune novels.
Oh, yeah, yeah, know? Yeah. I can see parallels.
They can't make big risks because if they don't pay off, they could lose everything.
Right.
So to survive and to make the necessary meta calculations here, the Illithids have this elder brain. Again, giant, immobile thought organ in a tank of brine. It's the colony's library of knowledge, a history of all their past lives. When they die, their own brains are returned mm-hmm. to the elder brain. It's a nexus of metacognition for the individuals in the colony, and likewise kind of serves the thralls as well.
You know what that sounds like to me?
What?
Cyborgism.
Yeah.
Except for it's using organic material. It sounds very much like what we talked about in our episode on cyborgism.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't help but think about human computing.
Yeah.
The entire system resembles in many ways human information networking systems and the ever evolving supercomputers that manage it. We're talking about the externalization and interconnectivity of thought. And as we drift ever closer to the technological singularity, when computer superintelligence truly eclipses that of humanity, it seems like we could be approaching our own age of the elder brain.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, think about it. The cloud, the way everybody talks about the cloud, we're just like offloading information to the cloud. And I don't know I mean, I guess we do have like people whose whole job is to maintain the cloud. I don't know that they're necessarily giving it delicate finger massages, but you know, mm-hmm. they work inside these data centers that house all this information. Yeah, that's our version of the elder brain.
We put all of our human knowledge into it. We put all these details about our daily life.
Yeah.
Even when we die, information about us lives on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what is the internet? What is the cloud but an elder brain? And you know, the more I think about it, I think I'd be okay with trusting. I'd feel safer trusting the world to an elder brain or in the human variation here, a super advanced artificial intelligence.
Yeah. So you're ready to give up to Skynet at this point. You're like, maybe it'll do a better job than we have.
It's kind of the Skynet situation, right?
Yeah,
because the mind flayers are saying, look, if we screw this up, we're doomed. We're done.
Right. Yeah.
So let's have this elder brain that's going to take care of all of those choices for us. And this way we can survive and maybe even rise again.
Yeah. And so I'm trying to think too, like parallels of this. If you know, like, so in the stories of mind flayers, mm-hmm. basically they'll protect the elder brain at all costs. It's, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I think it's a pretty high level monster to fight an elder brain or something, right?
Oh, like, yeah. Yeah. Like, they're pretty powerful.
Like they'll just like psychically wipe you out if you try to hurt them. But like imagine if you just destroyed the internet. You just took out the cloud. Now I know that's like, you know, pretty much as much fantasy as mind flayers at this point, right? But like a world right now without all of that data backed up that we've got would be an utter chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are we going to do for now? We're going to protect it at all costs, right?
Yeah.
That's like information is our primary resource right now. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. You sound like a modern human. You also sound like a mind flayer in saying that.
Yeah.
Which brings us back again to this area, this idea that the mind flayers are essentially us.
Yeah.
They may
yeah.
have tentacles. They may eat more brains than we do on a daily basis, but they're essentially humans with a very similar, reliance on information and informational systems. So think about that the next time you encounter one in one of your adventures.
Yeah, absolutely. Be a little bit more humane with the mind flayers that you may be attacking.
Yes, inhuman as
before,
they are.
Before you roll your initiative, think twice.
All right. So there you have it. Mind flayers.
So this was an episode that was a little bit of an experiment for us, and we had fun, but obviously we want to know if you had fun too. If you liked this kind of thing and you want more content like this from us in 2017, let us know. Okay. Reach out to us. Let us know on social media. We're thinking about doing something similar to this, maybe on our social media platforms when we do live videos. So remember, we're on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. Those are all places where you can find content like this or communicate with us. You can also find more information like this. If you liked this and you want more right now, there's lots of Monster Science and Monster of the Week articles on stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Yeah. If you want more monsters, let us know. If you want more D&D related content, role playing related content, let us know. And if there are any specific examples that we talked about in here, stuff from the natural world that you would like to see explored in greater depth, that's the kind of thing we can do as well.
Mm.
And as always, if you want to reach us in any way about this, you don't have to drill holes in our skull. You don't have to shoot, psionic mind blasts at our brains. You can email us directly at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.